Welcome, welcome. We are back for another episode of The Lock-In. I'm David Lappin, and I am joined, as usual, by birthday boy Dara O'Kearney. Well, it was actually your birthday yesterday, which means by the time this comes out, it was actually your birthday a couple of days ago. But regardless, a very happy birthday to you, Dara. You told me that you didn't do too much celebrating this year, as you are just so busy preparing for the, I don't know, poker onslaught that is ahead of us right now. Can you tell me about your schedule and what it looks like for the next, I don't know, 6 weeks or so?
Yeah, I didn't really do anything this year or any of the year for that matter, but I don't see the whole attraction of birthdays. I mean, literally everyone has one, so I don't see what the accomplishment is. I just read a piece actually just before about how narcissists make a really, really big deal about their birthday. It's a huge thing. So I guess hopefully that's a sign that I'm not a narcissist. But yeah, I've got a really packed schedule for the next 5 weeks now. Thursday, 2 days time, I'm flying to Portugal early in the morning via Madrid for the Portugal adventure. I'm there until Tuesday, and then I start my trek to Vegas via Toronto. And then I come back from Vegas. I actually wanted to try and fly relatively direct from Vegas to Bratislava, but there was no more direct way than through Dublin. So I'll be in Dublin for about 17 hours, I think, before then I go off for another trip for Bratislava. So all in all, I'll be away for more than a month. A mixture of dread and excitement. I also finally checked my flights too, which you were kind enough to book for me. And I'm coming back quite the circuitous route. It goes Vegas, Denver, Reykjavik, Dublin.
Yeah, you're welcome. That's Lappin's travel agency.
Yeah.
I think the big issue, I remember when you asked me, could you find a way back through to Bratislava? And I suppose you were ideally hoping for a one hop. But there just wasn't a way to do it to get you there so that you could play a tournament you wanted to play in Vegas and then also get there for the beginning of the Bratislava one. So, yeah, a bit of a circuitous one. Sorry about that. But look, that Bratislava festival, actually, I know it's a month away, but it sounds like great fun. And I'm actually really delighted that Unibet got to be part of that. They've qualified quite a few players for that stop. And I know we'll try and qualify a few more over the next couple of weeks. You mentioned the WSOP, of course. That's the big one for all of us. And I'll be joining you in the desert on the 4th of July, just in time for the main. I believe they're going to throw quite a big party for my arrival this year. Fireworks, that kind of thing. Nice of them. We've got some WSOP stories to cover right away. Not all positive, unfortunately. Let's start with a positive one, though. Daniel Hashem, Daniel, son of 2005 main event champion Joe Hashem, just came second in the double board bomb pop mix at the WSOP, narrowly losing out on a bracelet to Zhizhang Luo. We've actually already recorded an interview with Joe, actually, of all people, for the main event week episode of this podcast. So when the time comes, forgive us for not mentioning his boy's fantastic result. Dara, success in poker has a history of being passed down through the generations. Doyle and Todd Brunson, probably most famously. Barry, Jeff Shulman come to mind. Richard and Wai Kin Young these days. Obviously, in Ireland, we have Dunica and Owen O'D. And we also have the late Jenny Hegarty and her daughter, Willow Connolly. So maybe you want to tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we have quite a few examples. I mean, it's probably not that surprising. I mean, obviously, there are certain characteristics that make a good poker player, logical thinking and ability to read people, et cetera, just general game strategy, which could possibly be passed genetically. But I think more importantly, sort of the attitude when you're growing up it is a big factor. If you grow up in a household that views gambling and games like poker very negatively, then, you know, you're unlikely to get an early start. Whereas if you grow up in a household like the OD household or the Jenny / Willow households, then you are likely to be playing games from an early age. I mean, I started playing poker when I was 5 or 6, I think, because I grew up in a house where we just loved strategy games. So, and I think that's just generally true in Ireland. Like in Ireland, there's always been, first of all, not a particularly negative view of gambling. It's just seen as good fun, part of a balanced life. And but then also, like, there's real love of strategy games. Like when I read my aunt's books about their childhood, they talk about all the strategy games that they grew up playing, you know, 25, 45, all the card games that they played, Whist. So there's been that sort of long tradition in Ireland of people being introduced to those kind of card games at an early age. Maybe a side effect of being, for a long time, a relatively backward country with not much entertainment.
Indeed. Well, look, not suggesting for a moment that Australia is also a backward country that had no entertainment. I'm sure the Hashem household was vivacious with lots of different things. But congratulations to Daniel and obviously Joe, a proud dad today. To a couple of controversial stories now. First of these, Antonio Galeana, the Spanish player, pulled off an audacious bluff, it must be said, versus French poker pro Yo Viral. Heads up for a bracelet in the WSOP 2500 freeze out a few days ago. Most of you have probably seen it, but in case you didn't, it was a limp pot. The flop came 10-6-3 monotone clubs. The turn came the eight of clubs, and the river came the two of clubs. It was checked down to the river, so no betting at any point, at which point the ultimate game of chicken began as both players, both clubless, began representing initially an okay club, then the ace of clubs, and then eventually the 4-5 or 9-7 of clubs, I don't know, for a straight flush, as it went bet from Galeana, raise from Yo, click back raise from Galeana, another raise from Yo, and then eventually an all-in from Galeana, who showed the ultimate sort of willingness not to back down, I guess, in the end. Obviously, people did question whether Joe could actually call, or Yo, I should say, could actually call off the river bet, but that would have been even wilder, I suppose. It was a wild hand that some have compared to the one from years ago, epic hand, Phil Ivey, Paul Jackson. Dara, what did you make of the hand?
Yeah, I mean these spots are always incredibly confusing. First of all, the fact it's blind on blind means the ranges are so wide and they don't narrow at any point in the hand because no money goes in onto the river and the board ends up with five clubs. So it's a spot where like pretty much your entire value is flushes. Like you can't really bet. You can't, why would you even bet a set for value? It's not like you are going to get called by a pair. So the initial bet kind of makes sense. Like you have to find non-flushes to be your bluffs. And then the raise again, the bet itself is a little bit suspicious because you have to think, well, a lot of the club hands would put money in before the river, they would have either bet their backdoor on the flop, or if they were a flush, they would have bet, or they would have bet when the club came on the turn. So Yo's raise also makes sense, and he also has to find non-flush bluffs. And they both at every point in the hand on the river, all of their bluffs have to be non-flushes. So then it kind of comes down to you don't want to be blocking stuff that the other guy might have. That would have just checked down to the river, like maybe a pair that just wants to take its showdown. So it's actually kind of bad to have a board pair. So you kind of want to just have nothing, no interaction with the board, and just pray that the other guy doesn't have a club either.
Yeah, I guess everybody with the sort of same showdown. If you can just get there, if he's clubless and you're clubless, but these guys really didn't want to play a small pot in the end. They really wanted to play a big one. And I kept thinking to myself, is it almost like the 4-5 of clubs is actually what's ultimately being represented? Because maybe you wouldn't bet your small flush being a little bit trappy on the flop, and then it becomes actually not a particularly great flush, so you don't love it anymore, and then it becomes a straight flush, so you absolutely love it. But yeah, that's just my way of looking at the hand as I watch it play out. It was an absolutely wild one. This hand helped propel Galeana to victory, but no sooner was the bracelet on his wrist than a scandal was brewing with it, being alleged that he had orchestrated a complex scam involving a fake website and fake poker results to steal approximately 100 grand from the Team 651 poker stable. In a resurfaced 2018 2 plus 2 post, Team 651 co-founder Jason Philpott said, Galeana has been part of a stable that offered plus EV, sorry, not plus EV, offered EV deals to players, guaranteeing a player a certain percentage of their EV in all games played. So basically, sort of guaranteeing a player, maybe a 90% share, an 80% share in the money he sort of won Sklansky dollars style, and not based on results, which I suppose would flatten out variance very nicely for a horse. Dara, the alleged scam was quite elaborate, whereby fake spin and go hand histories and audits on PokerStars were created. What did you make of this? And I suppose, in light of it, what is the wisdom of such deals?
Yeah, it's. I mean, to be honest, I paid very little attention to the story, and he told me we were going to be talking about it, and and like everyone else, like I have no inside information. I don't know how true the allegations are not. These sort of arrangements are fairly common with spin and goes, because with spin and goes, like think about it. If you get into a in if you get a lucky spin and you're in a huge one, it's absolutely massive to your bottom line. whether you win that or not. You're playing for far too much money. So it's the same as when tournament players like us go deep and we sell pieces to reduce our variance, or someone like Jack Sinclair, who sold himself at ICM on the final table of the WSP main event when he made it. It kind of makes perfect sense from that perspective.
Yeah.
But obviously, the problem with all of these things is they are open to scam artists, and you know, no better people than a bunch of poker players to find some way to deal with the scam angle.
Well, look, there was quite a bit of back and forth on this story as it reemerged. Galliana told Poker News, "I'm in contact with my lawyer for defamation and harassment, and I have been advised not to speak for now." He's actually retracted that statement since, and it appears that both sides have, quote, resolved this matter to everyone's satisfaction. So something has been done to, you know, make them whole or somewhat whole. In a later statement, Philpott said Galliana had explained the limited scope of his involvement and we found him to be credible. Don't really know what to make of it. It just sort of sounds like he paid them off some or all of the money and sort of made out like there were worse people than him. I don't know. We're left to speculate really here. But it was a wild story arc for Galliana, who was hero to villain and then sort of like maybe somewhat forgotten about a few days later again. While I'm glad everyone has drawn a line under it, it was a suspicious story and it wasn't the only one last week, as it appeared that Men Win was up to his old tricks again, this time seemingly pulling chips back in a three-way pot, shorting the all-in player who won. Doug Polk did a YouTube breakdown of this incident in tremendous detail. It's far more comprehensive than anything we will do now. So I recommend you just go check that out if you haven't already and you care about this story. What I will say, though, is that when I started off in poker, Men the Master was one of the first names I ever heard when it came to cheating. I heard rumors of chip dumping, angle shooting stories, exactly like this one, actually, of pots being shorted. I don't know if they're... are any caught red-handed moments like Kasouf in Leeds, or if it's all he said, all these people said, stories like Kasouf in Dublin. But given that we also saw disgrace cheater Ali Imsirovic at the WSOP tables, I thought I'd ask you, Dara, about the difficulty we have when guys can get caught cheating in one venue or on one online site and then just show up at another. Do we need a blacklist? It's a question we've asked before.
Yeah, I think the problem is like it's just so hard to coordinate, and you know, almost everybody involved in poker is quite lazy. Not just players, but organizers as well. It just adds a huge amount of extra overhead to them. To multinational. We've had cases in the past. The guy who was apparently using Invisible Ink, who was banned in every casino in Europe, going over and running deep in the big heads up at the WSOP. So it's very hard to sort of globally police all these people. Men the Master, from what I understand, like most of the cheating allegations, at least when I came on the scene, were more along the line of people he put horses in and got them to chip dump to him, which you know is obviously cheating, but you know he's paying for those chips ultimately. So on the scale of cheating, it's not quite as bad as this latest incident. But certainly there've been lots and lots of stories about men. I mean, I remember the famous story of the power going out at the Rio at WSOP final table once, and as he used to periodically do, whenever it rains in Vegas, they just don't know what to do and everything stops working. And it rains about once a year, usually during the WSOP. So the lights go out, everybody's sitting in darkness, and then the lights come back on, and some wait in the audience shouted, "New chip leader, Men the Master."
Very good. Well, from blacklists to the player of the year list. Wow, what a segue that was. At the time of recording, Scott Seaver is top of the WSOP POY after two wins, one in the 10K Omaha 8 or better and the other in the 1500 Raz, bringing his bracelet tally to 6 in total. It was actually great to see, by the way, former guest Brandon Shaq Harris, who I know has had a tough month or so, take second in that Raz tourney a couple of days ago. Congrats to him as well. Seaver will be a difficult front runner to catch, no doubt, as he is pledging to go hard for this series this year. He normally picks just a few events, as far as I know, and instead concentrates on lucrative cash games in June and July in Las Vegas. Right behind him, though, are a couple of very familiar faces. Nick Schulman is in second after winning his fifth bracelet a week or so ago in the 25K High Roller. Robert Misraki is in third after winning his fifth bracelet in the 10K Dealer's Choice. Phil Ivey is behind him after taking down the 10K Deuce to Seven triple draw for his 11th bracelet. Also, all these guys ratcheting up lots of other caches as well. And also in the top 10 are John Reisner, Sean Deeb, and Dylan Wiseman, all people who can, you know, play all the games and are going to rack up points all over the place as well. And you know, who would back against a Sean Deeb picking up a bracelet at some point in this series and making a move to get into one of those top spots? It is fascinating to watch. Darren, I know it's very early, but that's a lot of quality in that bunch of players early on. Not always the case early on. Sometimes you see a bit more variance, a few surprise names, but it's all these big names in the mix. Who do you fancy?
I mean, to be honest, any of them could do it. The system has changed this year, obviously, so it hasn't just become about who's doing the most volume. And we did tend to see the same faces time and time again. The people who were committed to playing absolutely everything, or even multi-tailing in some cases, as we joked with recent guest Sean Deeb. Now it's kind of like more important to put up big results on the board rather than just lots and lots of results. Chris Ferguson would not win this year with his 43 min catches or whatever got him player of the year. It's actually great to see players like Scott. Like, Scott doesn't really get a lot of attention, but he's been around forever. He's been right up there. He's just a phenomenal player. So it's great to see him get some spotlight. Again, another funny story about Scott, just to really underline the fact that he doesn't get much spotlight. A friend of ours, Brad Wilson, booked Scott Seaver for his podcast, Chasing Poker Greatness, only to find that it was a different Scott Seaver who also plays poker. So even when people try and do give him spotlight, you know, there's another Scott Seaver out there who apparently is a very successful musician as well.
That's right.
who's competing for the attention. Nick Shulman's just amazing as well. Like, just such a great commentator, such a great player. It's great to see people like that in the mix. I'd be happy with either Scott or Nick winning.
Yeah, great picks as well. I think there's a lot of cream rising to the top of that leaderboard. And actually, Scott Seaver with the two wins this year, if he wanted to pick up a third one, making a great case for himself. I think this is the first year he's eligible for Hall of Fame, and certainly one of the big names in poker over the last 15 or so years. Probably played a lot in the cash games privately. So, you know, arguably, if he concentrated on tournaments, he'd have had twice or maybe more than twice the success we've seen, but still has had a lot of success in tournaments. So, yeah, we might see him make a play. I feel like sometimes the person who does really well at the series, if they are eligible for the Hall of Fame, it sometimes gives their candidacy a little boost. Speaking of player of the year race, one person who's not doing very well in this, unfortunately for him, is perennial tryhard Daniel Negreanu, who had the competition rules tailored to his own quality over quantity approach this year, as Darren mentioned, those rule changes. Now, we're only a third of the way through, so perhaps he can still turn his series around. At the time of recording, he's down over $250,000. The reason I bring up Daniel, a man who hasn't won a Vegas bracelet in 18 years, despite firing more bullets than anybody else in that period, is that he decided to take a pop at us on a recent episode of David Tuckman's 888-sponsored, I don't know, poker players in cars not getting coffee. I'm not sure what that show is called, but I did watch that episode after it got sent to me because I had been mentioned, as were you, Dara. Here's what the kid poker had to say.
On the outside looking in, sometimes it appears that you're looking for it. And I don't think that's true, but it appears that way sometimes. And I look at your fights, whether it be with, you know, Norman Chad, or whether it be with the Chip Race guys, podcast guys, Darryl Carney and David Lappin.
Yeah.
And I can go on. There's many people
those
out there.
Those two that you bring up are so perfect. First and foremost, I love my haters, like the doubters, people that have said, you know, those two in particular, I never came at them at all under any circumstances, right? Norm would always pick at me for, you know, using the F word and this and that, and, you know, sort of schooling me on how I needed to be. I'm like, you know, I'm just me, right? I never picked on this guy. He just kept coming at me. I never noticed it. Other people around me said, you know, he's like coming at you, right? And I'm like, I don't know. I always thought it was good natured until I realized that it wasn't. Like, he was actually like trying to insult me, right? Whatever. So, you know, I snapped back a couple times in response, right? It was never initiated. I never came at him. Those two weird dudes, like, it's so funny, like, that those guys, like, because people send them to me sometimes. They could be talking about anything. They could be talking about whatever. They'll find a way to make it a dig about me. You know what I mean? They literally, imagine trying to paint a picture of somebody in the worst possible light with no redeeming qualities whatsoever. That's where they go for, right? And it's not even like, honest. I think most people who see it go, wow, that seems like extreme, unfair, and unnecessary. But you know what?
They're basically the husband in Titanic. They had Zane characters.
Yeah, something like that. Or right. Like, and it's outrageous. Like, and the thing that, I guess the only thing that annoys me is when people actually flat out lie. You know, and just make stuff up. Or just like say things that are actually not true. Or quote me as saying things that I didn't actually say. So those beefs, when those ones specifically, those were nothing I initiated. No, the question is, you have two choices, right? People start throwing shit out there about you. Ignore it. Let it become fact. Or you know, argue for yourself, defend yourself to a certain degree. And then people say, oh, why do you even bother with that, right? So it's a lose-lose either way. But here's the thing. When you have haters and you accumulate them, you have to look at the benefit of, you have to look at the other side of that coin. It's like, that's because you've become something, right? If you were an insignificant pawn in the game and you didn't matter, nobody would care.
Okay, so Tara, I know that this is your first time watching this. You actually messaged me during the week when I was responding to it on Twitter. Something to the effect of, I should have pulled up the exact message, but I'm pretty sure this is close. Can you give me Cliff David? I can't bear listening to him and I haven't thought about him for years. Now that you've been forced to watch it, what is your response?
Yeah, my reaction when this blew up, it hasn't really changed. I was A, amused, and B, bemused that he even thought to mention us, and in particular me, because like I really don't think about Daniel these days, and I haven't mentioned him in years. We don't follow each other on social media. He barely ever impinges on my thing. I guess he's just doing what everybody else done, which is he's confusing and conflating and are considering us as the same person. So, you know, you constantly obviously do enjoy pointing out his many failures, and, you know, recent years have not been kind for him at the WSOP. He's been up there for player of the year, but I think he's pretty much booking constantly fairly big losing WSOPs. It just seems bizarre. I mean, it's 5 years now. And
it might be more.
Might be more, and still somehow it's in his mind. Also, just the insult, like weird, like that's just such a lame insult. It's like a catch-all when you can't impugn somebody's integrity or anything else about them. You just say, oh, they're weird. I mean,
are we weird, Dara? I don't know.
I mean, I don't mind being called weird. It's fine. I certainly don't want to be called conventional or boring. Weird, I would almost like weird as a compliment. And I think, you know, if Daniel reflects on it, you know, he might think maybe he's just a little bit weird himself. He's not a standard person. He's an outlier. I don't want to dump on Daniel just because he's taking a pop at us again. Like, as I said, I really don't think about him these days. But he, you know, he has in the past done a lot of service for poker, been a very good ambassador, got a lot of attention onto poker. And even now, you know, he still does that. And every so often he says something stupid and then more intelligent people weigh in. And it does actually shine a spotlight on some stuff which wants to be talked about. So he does sort of function as poker's useful idiot. So I don't want to be completely harsh on Daniel, but it was just weird. It's very, very, very strange. You don't really expect to be name checked 5 or 6 years on by Daniel after all this time.
No, and what I always think is interesting about the comparison is that you're right. You never mentioned him, actually. And I do maybe once a year write something about him because of something he said or something that's in the news. And actually, if you think about it, the fact that someone who writes, two articles a week, writes maybe one and a half articles per year on average about the most famous person in our game is actually me underrepresenting his sort of impact in the industry, because I don't really want to talk about him either. But, you know, when I do, or when I sort of feel like, well, there's nothing else to talk about this week and this thing is a big story, I always talk about his ideas or his results or fact-based stuff. And I do notice that he goes to like insults and diminutive little nicknames. And it doesn't really go to, you know, anything factual. He just goes to sort of, you know, ad hominem attacks.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, you know, fair play to him, though. Dick Napkin is a very funny.
It is objectively maybe the funniest thing he's ever said.
Yeah, his insult game is unfortunately, like everything else, is just deteriorating along with his poker game and his hairline. It's just like he a couple of years ago, he came up with Dick Napkin, which was genuinely funny. And now he's just coming up with weird, which is just like, yeah, okay, fine. Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking of things, becoming more diminutive or diminishing somewhat, I did tweet at him because I was just kind of a bit sick and tired, and maybe he just caught me before my coffee that morning. And I said, I'm concerned that in his old age, Dean Eggs is showing early signs of dementia. We came at him, question mark. He called certain poker players cancer. He made a gross comment about my girlfriend. He defended his own decision to blackface on multiple occasions. He made a gross comment about adoption and then doubled down on it with a disgusting comment to adopted man, which actually I think is maybe the worst thing I've ever seen from him, to be honest. The blackface stuff was pretty poor. The fact that he didn't apologize, pretty terrible. Obviously, having a pop at my girlfriend, well, I don't know why he decided to drag her into it. Absolutely no reason for that. But actually, this comment to the adopted chap on Twitter, I thought was, for me, maybe one of the grossest comments I've ever come across. I linked it in that tweet. He obviously oohed our podcast win and claimed we rigged the jury, which I actually thought was kind of funny that we could even do that. He's given me that lovely nickname, Dick Napkin, which actually I give him credit for. And then a few months ago, he ranted about me for 10 minutes on the Nick Fertucci show. 10 minutes of Nick Fertucci's hour-long show, and he decided to dedicate it to me and whatever way I've hurt his feelings. But anyway, whatever. I said at the end of that tweet, what did we do? Write a couple of blogs 5+ years ago criticizing something shitty that he said. The lad's deluded and a fucking crybaby. Well, I'm happy to stick with that statement. Okay, so it's time now to bring in our guest for this week. He is such a busy man that he told me he was only available for 20 minutes, which was eating into his dinner break during a 17-hour work day. Nonetheless, we still wanted him on because it's always a boon to welcome to the show poker player, staker, ambassador, and now podcaster, our great pal, the 2008 Irish Open champion, Neil Channing. Neil, welcome.
I'm still searching for something I do well, so I'm trying new things. I mean, if two guys get together in a room for more than half an hour, it's like the law now that they have to start a podcast.
That's how we started, Dara, isn't it? That's just what happened. We just kept thinking people would actually be interested in hearing our guff.
Yeah, pretty much. And I'm also going to believe the 20 minutes when I see it. I mean, the first time we interviewed Neil, I remember we told him it's going to be 20 minutes and sent him into a blind panic.
I think it was about 18 years ago. I was sharing a house with Paul Spillane, that some viewers in Irish poker will know, who used to be the card room manager at Boyle's and invented the IPO. He said to, I was cracking away betting on sports on a Saturday afternoon, and he said, if I filmed you, people would pay a fortune to watch this shit.
we're about to find out. So, Neil, I said how you have just added podcaster to your resume. Your new show, Bet the House, launched 10 days ago. You've put out 2 shows so far. I have listened to both and very much enjoyed both. Can you tell us about it?
Well, yeah. Well, you will know, David, because regular viewers will probably know that you live in Malta. And I happen to be in Malta for random non-poker reasons. And I thought, well, I don't know that many people in Malta, and I reckon David will enjoy a good lunch. And I came to you and said, you know about podcasts, everything there is to know. And I've sort of had this idea that I like politics and I like betting. And I like listening to people talking about betting on politics. And nobody ever seems to do that. So I don't know whether it's because in the UK, it's, people are squeamish about talking publicly about politics. But anyway, I thought there's way too many politics podcasts that are a load of old rubbish. But there aren't any talking about betting on politics. And eventually I was getting so frustrated. I thought, well, I'll just have to start one up myself. The problem is I'm technically completely inept. I'm a big procrastinator. So, I think it was at least 2 years ago I came to talk to you and say, how the hell do you do it? Where do you get a microphone from? How do you switch on the camera and stuff like that? And you gave me
which,
a
by the way, wouldn't
of...
be my strong area. I would not be the technical guy either.
Well, you bluffed me good because I thought, Jesus, this guy knows everything about starting up podcasts. I wish I'd have written notes now. And then I had a couple of people that were sort of vaguely interested in doing it. I think we made a pilot episode around about 7 months ago. And 3 days after they called the election, I think I messaged both of them and said, look, if we're going to actually do this thing, it's really bad if we don't do it during this election. That seems like a good time to start a political betting podcast. So we finally did it. It was basically Rishi Sunak spurred us into it.
Well, might be the first decent thing he did. Your first episode was about British politics mostly. It was very British politics centric, as I imagine maybe will be the dominant focus till after the election. I know most of our audience isn't British, though. So let's speak about election betting a bit more generally, if you don't mind. Mm. In what kind of bets can you usually find the biggest edge here, Neil?
Well, I think, I mean, basically, everyone loves betting on elections, and American elections are easily the biggest game in town. I mean, Betfair, the world's biggest betting exchange, the biggest two traded markets they've ever had were the two elections where Donald Trump was standing. So by far, you know, and then the next eight things in the list are all cricket matches, you know, because they have so many. I mean, American viewers are now lost. They don't know what I'm talking about. It's sort of baseball, but in a different way. Anyway, the main bet, you know, right now, you can bet kind of 60% Trump, 40% Biden, roughly speaking, to be the next president. I actually haven't checked for a few hours. Neither of them have gone completely senile in that time, have they? That was roughly the price last time I looked. I mean, obviously, that's all fun and games, and there's millions of pounds changing hands on that. But there's not going to be too many mistakes in that. The market has knocked that into shape over a period of time. If you want to bet on a swing state, though, Nevada or Wisconsin or Pennsylvania, it just gets a lot more interesting because now people have opinions. And when people have opinions, they can be wrong. And there are inherent biases in the market. Some markets, you get situations where just, you know, the kind of customers that bet on betting exchanges are likely to go one way or the other. There are times where recency bias is a big thing. People overreact to the news that they've just seen. So if Biden dribbles and falls over, you know, he drifts in the market, and then Trump can't remember the name of his best doctor or whatever, and he drifts in the market, and this stuff just goes back and forward all the time. And if you're a good sort of picker of the market, which everybody, you know, we've all been talking about Bitcoin for the last however many years, everybody thinks they know where markets are going to move in the next 4 hours. I mean, if you play poker in America, you can't move without finding someone who's an expert on market volatility. So it's, you know, betting on policy is the perfect thing because it just goes on all the time.
Well, that is a fantastic and very fulsome answer, but it unfortunately is the incorrect answer. What we were looking for was the bets that you can usually find the biggest edge on is when you can bet on an election that's already happened. Because we've had
Well, that's true. I mean, that is true. I mean, but, you know, the end of the world was possible then, wasn't it? I mean, you know, it's like, you know, people say, I heard that the world was ending and you could get 500 to one on it happening, you know, bet a grand on it. But I mean, that it did seem at the time a bit crazy that, you know, December, you could still bet on people were still betting on Trump to win the election long after they'd had an inauguration. Yeah, pretty strange. But
I'm looking forward to a repeat of that. I just want to tune into your, you know, November 30th episode where you're like, yeah, you should bet on Biden now because he's already won. So just do the entire episode. I'm going, bet on the thing that happened already.
I've got some bad news for you, though. I think the other guy's going to win, actually. But it's definitely, we will definitely switch the focus from UK to American. I think originally we sort of thought that every show would, you know, have a combination of each. And this year there are so many elections, you know, they just had a massive election in India. The situation in France is very fluid at the moment. They're having an election, not for the president, but for MPs. That's kind of I don't know, people in America might not have been following that. France is the kind of big country just to the right of the UK. They a few people from there turn up at the World Series of Poker. You've probably seen them.
They wear scarves
fashionably,
not because they're covering up. Yeah,
that kind of thing. But no, they had a very controversial one. There was an election to the European Parliament about 10 days ago, and basically all the far right parties did really well in Germany and France and Austria. The French President Macron thought he would outfox them by calling an election, which he's now going to get roundly thrashed in. They're saying that this is strategic genius by him because he's going to let the Nazis come in and prove that they can't run the country. I don't know why they don't. They never seem to do give that privilege to the left, do they? They're determined to never let them have a crack at it. But anyway, yeah, so that'll be fun. But it's all getting exciting over there. I think there's enough elections happening in the world. There's always an election somewhere in the world, basically. It's a bit like the World Series of poker. It never ends.
Well, Dara, we do very little betting away from poker, probably compared to a lot of punters, but we do a little bit of politics betting. I know we both made bank on the last US election. How do you see this year's US presidential rematch shaping up? Do you think it will be the half senile guy who can't walk up steps, or will it be the half senile guy who can't walk down slopes?
I think, I've gone back and forth on this. And, you know, I always think about what our friend and former guest and now sadly departed, Jan Sukarnik, who was an amazing sports bettor, used to say. He used to say, like, figure out what stupid people are betting on and then just take the other side, because they're moving the line, particularly on the smaller markets. On the bigger markets, as Neil said, it's going to be corrected out. You know, we're observers of the American circus as much as anybody else. But the line which strikes the truest for me is something Barry Carter said to me recently. Barry said he thinks that Trump will win because Biden just looks permanently befuddled, and that alarms Americans. Whereas Trump, while what he's saying is often horrendous, at least he says it very vigorously, and he looks vigorous for his age. And, you know, at the end of the day, he feels that that's going to affect enough people's perceptions when it comes to voting. You know, Nate Silver talks about a lot about low information voters. Low information voters often just go on that sort of appearance type stuff. So, yeah, I think similar to Neil, I think Trump has to be the strong favorite at this point.
You are making me the strong favorite for a second there, Donald. I'm more senile than both of them.
Yeah.
Well, Dara, in my article about Bet the House, Neil's great show, I made a general point about podcasting that I'd love you to weigh in on. I said finding success in podcasting is great, but it has to be secondary to making the show because it's worthwhile in and of itself. We're obviously very lucky to have a sponsor now for this show and the Chip Race, but that's exactly how we started out, actually. We made the show for free because we wanted to initially shine a light on poker in Ireland. Can you speak about our internal philosophy on this show and how it relates to something your old pal David Bowie once said?
Yeah, I mean, when we started, we were a purely Irish podcast, and it was an Irish company that owned it, and they made deliberately niche podcasts. So it was sort of like niche podcast into a market which itself is quite small. The Irish market. So we really had to struggle to try and appeal to as many people as possible, and also to make a lot of noise about the show to get any sort of audience. That was kind of the idea. So we came up with this concept of, like, we'll have seven different segments on every show, and probably nobody will like all seven, but if they like three, four, or five, that'll be enough to pull them in. And different people will like different segments. So that's how you appeal to as wide an audience as possible without completely, you know, bastardizing or diluting it down to just being lowest common denominator nonsense, which we didn't want to do either. But yeah, like, from my discussions with Bowie, like, Bowie was one of the great artists of the last century, not just in music, but everything he touched. But he had this idea that, like, art was not this pure thing. It was essentially a communication between the artist and the audience. And if there was no audience, there was no art. When he was in the studio, he said he was an artist. He was just thinking about what was the most interesting art he could make at any given point. But then as soon as that was finished, that job was done. And the next job was to get out there and sell it and promote it as actively as possible. And you know, the word he used was prostitute. At that stage, you weren't thinking anymore about the art. The art was finished. Your input was done. You now had to go out and attract the audience and use whatever means necessary to do that. And that's kind of been, you know, more so in the early days. I guess these days we have a reliable audience, and we feel to a large extent that we probably capped out within the poker arena, so we don't have to make the same efforts to tell them every time we have a show. But you know, we still do our best to promote it overall.
I think, and with that in mind, I want to come back to you, Neil, because I'm convinced that you're going to be somebody who's very good at making the art, but maybe Are you more reluctant to sell it in that way?
I'm not a reluctant salesman, but I noticed that Bowie's word was particularly good for poker podcasts in terms of SEO. I mean, you know, if you want to get a word that poker players are likely to be typing into their search engine, you know, Bowie had it right there. Prostitute, that was always going to get them. I think, you know, I've picked two quite good partners for this show. I should give them some credit because you never know, they might listen to this and think that I'm just saying it's my podcast. Nick Gluck is very involved. He's got a great name for gambling. He's a bit of a legend in UK horse racing. He used to present horse racing on Channel 4 when that was a thing. He now presents horse racing on NBC in America. And he presents horse racing in the UK as well, so on racing television. And I started doing this TV show with him about horse racing because that's the thing I like. And we got talking about this podcast. So having him is brilliant because he's got, I don't know, 100,000 Twitter followers or something. So he's got some kind of reach and he's on TV. So that really helps us to sell it. And the other guy that we've got involved is a fellow called Rory Campbell. And his father, Alistair, was kind of rather involved in a government that some people thought did quite well and other people weren't so keen on, mostly the Iraqis. But he's really helped us to market it. His father gave us a few retweets and he's got like 1 million followers. So that's been quite good for promoting it. But I'm interested because what you were saying there, Dara, because I think our podcast is quite niche. You know, obviously there's gazillions of politics podcasts out there and there's a lot of gambling podcasts. But as far as I know, there aren't any gambling on politics. So we weren't sure what category to put it in when we set it up. Yeah, you have to input a category. And we went for government. It turns out it's not that difficult to go up the charts in government. We went to number 2 after about half an hour. and by the end of the day, we were number 1. So we're top of the charts podcasters. I don't know what that means. I think once about 60 people had listened to it, we were the number 1 in government.
You're being far too modest. I already saw your numbers on a few of the platforms and I can tell that it's going to be a big hit. Neil, you are an ambassador as well for Sky Poker. Got to bring it back to poker a little bit here for the sake of the show, which it must be said is a very friendly site, actually, a bit like Unibet, lots of loyal regulars. You have a couple of live stops, I know, coming up in Manchester and Brighton. Do you want to plug them?
I need to. The Brighton dates haven't been announced, so now I can't remember the Manchester one off the top of my head. It's I think it's at the end of August, roughly speaking, in Manchester. They're Sky. I mean, yeah, you're right. I think Sky and Unibet are quite similar. I sort of like to think that Unibet kind of, you know, got the idea. Oh, look what they're doing at Sky. You know, we have a forum, and I find, you know, I've played on a few different sites over the time. I find the checkbox on Sky is generally kind of a friendly place to hang out. People, you know, genuinely say pretty much at the end of every tournament, if you know, you get to the final, if you, on the rare occasions you get to the final table, if you get knocked out, someone will say good night, mate, you know, rather than just GG or nothing. It's you know, and actually because it's quite small, you know, the tournaments are quite not huge fields. You know, the Sunday major will get less than 200 runners. You're not playing till 6 in the morning, which for an old geezer like me, it suits perfectly. You know, you can be all done by 1 a.m. or very normally much earlier than that. No, I like it. And I like the fact that if I'm sitting down to play, because of the live events and the sort of small body of regulars, I feel like I kind of can bring up the faces in my mind of the people on the table. And, you know, that helps me. Because I'm not brilliant with there's no software on Sky, so it's you're just remembering, you know, oh, it's that guy with the ginger hair, he's a massive bluffer, I remember that from Manchester or something.
Very good. Well, I know in previous years as well you've sent lots of players to the WSOP. Are you doing the same thing this year?
Sending them is correct. I'm not accompanying them. I've decided there's way too much going on in the UK to go and hang out in Vegas. But yeah, they've got 30 odd players going. They get like a 4 grand package week in the Venetian, or the Palazzo actually. And yeah, they get to play a nice tournament while they're out there, and generally it's a good crack. They sort of do quite good with their thing. They don't just do one big satellite and send everyone that way. They have a sort of multitude of ways of qualifying. So they'll have a bunch of promotions, some involving sit and goes, some involving cash races and stuff like that, so that they get a blend of players. And most of the rigs feel like whichever is their speciality, there's a way that they can qualify for Vegas. And that way, I'd say roughly speaking, half the people that go have been before, and they're pretty reggy on the site. I quite like that.
And have you been following the WSOP action? Obviously, we talked about it earlier in the show before you arrived, but interested to know how much tabs you're keeping on all of that. I suppose we're, 15 or so days, 20 days in?
I wasn't keeping a huge tab on it early on because I was feeling, you know, even if you've decided you're not going to go, there's always a moment where you suddenly think, oh, God, I could be there right now playing in that one, or that idiot's won one. I'm better than him. Now I'm thinking about going out and buying one of those bucket hats. Didn't you think? I thought Phil Ivey looked much cooler in the pictures now than he did in the ones from 10 years ago. Is that me or not?
I don't know if he pulled off the bucket hat. Look, everyone's saying he did, but I think it's just because he oozes so much coolness. They think he can wear a bin bag and probably look cool. But I actually thought it was pretty tragic.
I quite like the bucket hat, but even irrespective of whether you were a fan of the bucket hat, I just thought he looked very cool. And I didn't think he looked that cool 10 years ago. But the other person who left a real long gap between two bracelets was a good friend of mine, Richard Ashby. Chufty. It used to be a well-known expression, Chufty wins pot, because that seemed to be all you ever read on PokerStars as it flicked up. He would win pot after pot after pot. People used to go up to him in the Vic all the time and go, Chufty wins pot, Chufty wins pot, Chufty wins pot. So I did text him, Chufty wins bracelet, Chufty wins bracelet. I hadn't spoken to him for a while. He was very excited. I think it was 14 years between bracelets, and both stud bracelets. I mean, who's doing that these days?
Yeah, very impressive. I saw Adam Owen, I think, was his heads-up opponent in that one. I was obviously rooting for Adam Owen as well. It was great to see them both there.
Yeah, Adam Owen is a lovely guy and a really good player. And Chufty has got a bit of a legendary status in Australia. So he had a kind of an Australian rail because he's been to Australia to play the Aussie Millions about 10 times and they love him out there for some reason. And he said to me, I was really embarrassed because the Aussie rail were being really rude to Adam and I really like Adam. And I felt a bit embarrassed about it. And I tried to do a deal with him so he could have the bracelet because I wasn't that bothered about winning it, that we couldn't really agree on it. And he said I think he went down to 3 antes. The ante was 1,000. He went down to 3,000 heads up and then he came back and won it.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize it was a comeback of that nature. Wow, that's a pretty sick one, all right. To be fair, I've been in a tournament when Adam's had his own final table rail and they're pretty fucking rowdy. So if he got a little bit of his own medicine there, I don't think there's any harm.
He's a good guy, Adam.
He's a great lad. Before we go, I've got a very special thing that happened a few weeks ago, actually, to mention. Former guest Michael Dwyer took second in the GG Poker Super Millions for 1.3 million quid, the third largest result ever by an Irishman behind Andy Black and Ono D in the main event. I just spent a week with Michael, actually, in Malaga at the Estrellas event. We had a few glasses of Rioja to celebrate his result. Dara, I believe you made it to his party in Dublin just before that trip.
Yeah, he had a sort of an impromptu party near where he lives in Blackrock. And it was pretty much a who's who of Irish poker. I said it to him that it was a real tribute to how highly he's regarded and how much people like him. You really see what people think about poker players when they win something. A lot of the time is very grudging praise or even not praise. Whereas like everybody there was genuinely thrilled for Michael. And, you know, you had their young guns like Stephen Keough and a lot of the top young guys. And then you had the older players as well. Donal Cody was there. So the full panoply of Irish poker was there. And it was great to see. Everybody was thrilled. Michael is such a classy guy himself. You know, we've had him on the show, obviously. And I watched the entire final table while I was playing online, and we were talking a bit about Jonathan Jaffe's commentary, which was very, very good. We have Jonathan on a forthcoming episode of the Chip Race soon, And Michael is a genuine enthusiast, somebody who really looks accentuates the positive in life, and great to see somebody pull off. Like it's the biggest ever online score by an Irish player, which is incredible in itself, and it's the third biggest score live or online by an Irish player. So absolutely huge in the big scheme of things.
I don't know if you knew, but I had known Michael really well for like 15 years. So we actually, I don't want to overplug Sky Poker, but we had just been to a Sky Poker tournament, me and my partner, and it was in Glasgow. And while I was in Glasgow, I heard that Michael had won this money, but I didn't realize what kind of tournament it was. I just assumed it was in a World Series event if someone's winning like more than a million. So I sent him a message saying, oh dear, sorry to hear you didn't quite win a bracelet, but I suppose the money's not too bad or something like that. And then he said, oh, I'm having a party in Ireland tomorrow. Why don't you come? And literally, we had just got off of 10 hours of trains to go from Glasgow to Devon. And we were just thinking how lovely it was to have a nice rest in Devon. And I said, well, actually, I'm exhausted, really. We just come from Glasgow and it was like yesterday. And we'd have to like leave now to get to Dublin by, you know, whenever. And he said, well, I'll send you the money for the flights if it helps. It's just like, wow. I was very tempted, actually. But yeah, it looked like a great party, actually. He's a very nice guy. He's a very nice guy, Michael.
Yeah, it was a great party on every front, because often these things drag on too long too. But Mike was very keen to get out of there by 10 o'clock. He was like, I have to fly to Malaga as well. So yeah, it was short and sweet, which is the best kind of parties. And actually, speaking about Irish poker, while I think about it, I'm going to wedge in one last plug. Today we announced that the Expo conference is going to take place in the Intercontinental at the same time as Fintan's event there. It's going to be a major conference, mostly focused specifically on poker. People have been around for a long time might remember that when they moved the WSOP to the Rio, they did something similar. And that's where Fintan actually got this idea for a poker-centric conference. There are a lot of general gambling conferences out there, but this one is focused on poker. So, yeah, I was happy to announce today on my social media that I would be an ambassador for that. Of course, immediately I got a slew of abuse from everybody about the amount of these things I do. Barry Carter was straight in there with me superimposed onto a picture of Krusty the Clown saying, I heartily product or event. It reminded me that about 10 years ago, I remember talking to a couple of top people in the industry, and we're just talking generally about sponsorship. And they were like, yeah, mate, you'll never be sponsored again. You're just far too old. We only sponsor young people. That's the way the poker industry works. So I far prefer people abusing me over the amount of sponsorships I get rather than the fact that I'll never be sponsored again.
And Derek, it doesn't look like quite the cynical plug that it was. Edge, as is, I think is the title for the expo, is going to basically be a sort of a poker-centric gambling, a bit like these kind of big conferences, Sigma and whatnot, but it'll be instead just for poker, right?
Yeah, that's very much the focus. The focus is on poker. It's happening at the same time as the major poker event that has to come in Ireland between now and the end of the year, in the Intercontinental, which was a massive success last year. The Intercontinental itself is an incredible venue. Reminds me very much of the Wynn in Vegas. So it's going to be great. Yeah, they're still scrambling to put it together. They're trying to line up a moderator. You know, they need somebody who knows how to talk, is able to debate. You know, I mean, who could that possibly be? Maybe somebody with a philosophy background. No idea what that might be.
There could be an announcement in the near future. We'll have to see. On that note, thank you very much to both of you. That's it for another lock-in. It remains for me to thank Neil Channing.
Well, thank you. Thank you for letting me promote Beat the House, the excellent new gambling politics podcast. There we are.
Wait, hang on. Did you just call it Beat the House?
I got it wrong. I said the wrong name. I'm useless.
Jesus Christ.
I was about to say that's a great name. Is it Bet the House?
It's Bet the House.
Okay.
Because I will be honest.
The absolute worst.
Well, unedited show, so.
Yeah, we're done.
Have to change the name of your podcast now.
I have to be honest, I did spend the week accidentally typing in betting the house and then would have to correct it to bet the house. So I made a little mistake. But it was your show. You should know the name of it.
I know, we spent weeks talking about what we were going to call it. And I think there's like three other podcasts called Bet the House.
Oh, there are a few. I did notice that you had a bit of competition for name. But look, yours will be the biggest one before long, I have no doubt. Darrell Kearney, thank government. You so much. Darrell Kearney, thank you so much for your contributions too.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I empathize with Neil's difficulty remembering his own name. I remember getting terrible abuse from Barry Carter that I couldn't remember the name of our first book because it was three words, poker, satellite, strategy, but I could never remember the order. So
that's it. That's it. It can be difficult. It can be very tough. Very best of luck in Portugal, Dara, and obviously in Vegas before I get there.
Yeah. The dread I was feeling of being away for 5 weeks, some of it is starting to subside, and there's a little bit of excitement coming into the fact I'm going to be in Portugal, Vegas, and Bratislava for the next 5 weeks.
Just be at least the same amount of wealthy by the time I see you. I don't want to arrive to a very, you know, downward spiraling doke who's had like 20 bricks.
Love that. You love that, really.
How about win a bracelet just before I get there? That'd be nice.
Yeah, I'll try and do that. Yeah, my first event out there is going to be the rich old folks event as opposed to the old folks event that
which I'm not able to play, by the way, contrary to it. 27 people have asked me this week
because you're not rich enough
because I don't have 5 grand. Good night, everyone.